I'm Brian McCreath from WCRB, and I'm at Symphony Hall with John Ferrillo. He's the principal oboist of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. John, thank you for taking some time right after your rehearsal of the Mozart Grand Partita to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
So you're doing this Mozart without conductor, and so the first question is, how does that work? Is there a designated leader within the wind section that's playing the piece, or is it a much more level, sort of democratic model, I should say?
Well, anytime you get 13 people to get, there are people that are more assertive and less in a public situation. But don't forget that the Boston Symphony winds the core group, form a woodwind quintet that's part of the chamber players. We often do serenades. So we're really very experienced at putting these things together. For sure, when there's a conductor, there's some streamlining. You need a little more time to work out who's beginning what. There are always these hilarious moments, you know, when you think you've marked the cue for who starts each movement, and then all of a sudden you say to everybody's looking at you expectantly, and you realize, oh my goodness, I was supposed to give that. But on the whole, we do pretty well in that regard, and we have developed a very coherent sense of ensemble, not just for Mozart serenades, of course, or the Dvorak or the Brahms, which we've also done. But, you know, to function as a wind section in general. So it's not as difficult a project as you might think.
In terms of the Grand Partita itself, what are the specific challenges of this piece? Do they involve, like, if you're going to say what the highest challenge is for the entire ensemble, is it the individual technique of the parts, or is it the simple length?
In every single way, it is. So it has, there are three Mozart wind serenades that are played. There's a C minor, often called the oboe serenade by wind players because it features quite a bit of oboe in it. There's the E flat, which features quite a bit of clarinet. Both of these pieces are perhaps 23, 24 minutes. This is 55 minutes. There's some conjecture about whether pieces like these were ever really meant to be done in a formal setting, because they are supposed to evoke, for sure, the outside, celebratory occasions. I wouldn't say necessarily they're meant to be seen as background music, but it's a lighter environment. And I could point out one famous example of a serenade that is, as far as I know, never performed as an individual piece, but Mozart wrote a serenade for the final scene of Don Giovanni, which is a party. I have, by the way, gotten dressed up in 18th century garb. I remember I did this in the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, and of course the party is crashed by the stone guest who's about to drag Don Giovanni off to hell. But before he does that, thank goodness, Mozart wrote a delightful wind serenade, I believe, an octet. And that as well is the kind of setting. You know, my colleagues were joking that to be appropriate, that maybe we should have a big punch bowl out during this for them. At any rate, this is in seven movements. The other pieces I mentioned are in four. And the movements themselves are on a large scale. It has a gorgeous slow movement that's been used in a number of movies, actually, the most famous one being the movie Amadeus.
And that's the scene where Amadeus is parting around and he hears the wind start and he has to rush down the hall to begin conducting. It's that particular little moment.
I've forgotten that detail.
And it's the oboe, actually. It's the oboe that alerts him that this is going on.
Right. And that, by the way, is a gorgeous, gorgeous oboe solo. I would say it stretches the technical parameters for all of us. You have, first of all, endurance. You have a great deal of incredibly delicate high register playing for us. You have charming, colorful, brilliant variations. Which is supposed to sound, you know, facile and light, but is extremely difficult. The bassoon has a lot of center stage stuff and the variations and very quick. It ends with a fiery I mean, it repeats it a number of times. So it's a challenge in every possible way, every possible way.
So getting back to what you were saying about your experience together doing this kind of music. I mean, the core group of the chamber players plus the section players, of course, joining in many times on this kind of music. Is there a kind of way that you would define the wind sound in this, in terms of a section of the BSO?
Well, I'd start with the superlatives about it. It's, you know, we've been together as a group since Elizabeth Thoreau arrived. I've been here 16 years. She arrived in my, I believe, my third year. I've been lucky twice in my life. There was a very coherent, homogenous sounding wind section in the Metropolitan Opera, where I was very lucky to work for 15 years. So I would say that that aspect of it, people really know what they're on the same wavelength, in part because we do so much chamber music. And that, I think, is something very special. Now, in terms of other adjectives to describe the sound, if that's what you're looking for, I'd say that we're representative of what has become a traditional American wind section, which is very strongly influenced by French masters. And by the way, this was a very, very French orchestra after World War I. So I was preceded by two very famous Parisians, Langer, who, by the way, his daughter taught my teacher solfège at Curtis. Madame Langer was a famous, famous lady. Mr. Langer was succeeded by Fernand Gillet, who taught at the New England Conservatory and played till just after World War II. Gillet's uncle was my teacher's teacher, if this is getting too small for you. And my teacher's teacher, Tabateau, taught wind class at Curtis for 35 years, I'd say, and taught most of the wind players of a certain generation in this country. And in particular, I think you could, even 20 years ago, go into the Boston Symphony wind section, and almost every one of them had coached first with Tabateau, the teacher at Curtis, my teacher's teacher, and also at the Marlborough Festival. You know, there's a famous Marlborough connection where Marcel Moïse taught, famous flutist, famous coach. And they were all trained at the Paris Conservatory. And I would say that wind tradition is approaching 200 years. So it is known for homogeneity, but flexibility. A lightness of approach to things. It's definitely not a Germanic approach in that sense. And also a particular approach to how one plays staccatos and legatos. And that's both a musical, a question of color, and a musical, what kind of sort of skeletal structure the music has, how people build phrases. So.
And so the way you're describing this, I guess I never really connected the dots before, that the when you describe the really dominant direction of wind playing in this country evolving out of France, that sort of intersects straight with the legacy you mentioned of the BSO in general,
right,
in a way that doesn't with other orchestras. That same
now,
legacy
of
doesn't
exist. Of course, there's a slightly darker side to all of this, and that there were very strong German traditions in the orchestra, and then World War I famously disrupted that. And,
right.
And without going too much into the details of that, it really did become much more predominantly French. And of course, Koussevitzky came, and Koussevitzky's second home was Paris. So that only served to reinforce it. But it's a very definite aesthetic. It's a beautiful aesthetic. And I should point out one other thing, that Symphony Hall itself, with its extremely mellowing and warm, is a perfect environment for that lighter approach. And in fact, even though I was trained in the Curtis Institute to be able to do these things, to play, when I came to Symphony Hall, I had to work on my piano, my pianissimo, my attacks, even more. than I had for a number of years. So,
You anticipated my next question, which is you mentioned 15 years in the Met, and obviously you came here. You had played here a bit before actually taking the job here, so everybody was a known quantity. You and the orchestra knew each other well, but settling in as principal oboist, how much did you have to change and adjust?
Oh, you always. I mean, a good musician is constantly adjusting, sure, even within the same ensemble.
But to play with the BSO as opposed to the Met Orchestra, even leaving aside the difference in opera and orchestra, the symphony orchestra, what characteristics had to sort of continue to evolve in a particular way for you? You mentioned symphony hall. How about, you know, your relationship playing-wise with the string section, all of that?
Well, when I came, the first thing that struck me when I entered the orchestra, I'd say it was my unofficial audition. The very first notes I played, they needed somebody to come in and do the final week of Tanglewood. And the very first notes they heard was the delightful Respighi, Fountains of Rome. It's very Italianate, and it begins with this silvery, you know, and I heard that, and I was enchanted because of the same elegant, light, transparent sort of violin and general string sound. This is not to denigrate. There was a very rich and full sound at the Met.
Sure.
But I, as a wind player, that kind of silvery approach to sound is particularly wonderful for the treble winds, for the clarinet, oboe, and flute. That was an easy adjustment. And then there's just the adjustment of getting to know people and just sort of melding, you know. I would say it took a couple years, 2 or 3 years. And by the way, it was not an easy transition. I mean, they knew of me, and they knew my playing from broadcasts. But let me tell you, I was used to being in a safe little hole in the ground most of the time, and I kind of liked it.
I literally
play an occasional beautiful oboe solo, but to be on stage in the, you know, there's once a joke when the Met Orchestra first started doing symphony concerts.
Yeah, because about 4 or 5 a year. Yeah.
I'd been there 3 or 4 years, and they've become very accomplished.
Fabulous
symphony concerts. But I remember one person describing our very first concert as like moles for the first time blinking in the open light. And which all of us, you know, we were kind of proud that we'd survived the experience, but I remember thinking, you know, that's not a bad description. Well, there I was, a mole come out into the bright light.
I mean, talking about it, yes, nobody's placing any judgment on any ensemble. I mean, the fact is the Met Orchestra is built to be a particular tool in its world, and the mm-hmm. BSO is a particular tool in its world, and if I can, like, be that blunt about it. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is when you hear those strings and they have that special transparency that happens and it's magnified here in symphony.
And then you are playing in that hall.
Yeah.
Which has a very particular resonance. You have to make sure that you're not playing things that are too tubby, in fact, because they will just be too loud, too forceful.
Oh, okay.
So you yourself have to, it's a night and it's a very welcome change. Whereas other acoustics, you have to add sort of a little more of the bass. It's like having a speaker with a little more of a woofer.
Is it too simplistic to say that you even maybe have to work less? Like it doesn't take as
well. The Met acoustic was a very good acoustic, and Carnegie is a very wonderful acoustic. So they're just different.
Okay,
I would say work in a different way. I mean, really soft, transparent things, which are such a specialty of this wind section. I had to learn how to do that. I had to redevelop. Fortunately, I was trained by teachers that really had great strengths in that department.
Okay, but at the same time, you grew up in this area. So it's not as though the BSO could have been completely mysterious or a brand new thing to you. Did you grow up hearing the BSO?
Well, your perceptions of an orchestra when you're a high school student. I'm often so
sure,
happy and
enough.
Proud to say that. Now, my dad was stationed at Hanscom Field, Air Force Base.
Okay.
But we lived in Bedford, and we lived there 9 years. Dad was an engineer. So we had it really was my home. My ninth year, I graduated high school and went off to school. And I was in the Greater Boston Youth Symphony.
Yeah,
Walter Eisenberg.
Yeah.
Robert Corley was a wonderful mentor and coach to me. And I'm surrounded by, you know, Sato Knudsen and Gus Sebring. And one of the funniest things is I realized when I came, my official audition week, it's Chike 5. That's just the only thing that I could bust loose from the Met to come and do. And the last time I'd done it was in Sanders Theater, and Gus Sebring was playing the solo, and we were both 16. I was 16, he was 15, I think.
And he's the associate principal horn.
And he's the associate principal horn of the Boston Symphony. And there are other people as well, by the way. And people that were in the Greater Boston Youth Symphony right before me. Ronan Lefkowitz and Larry Wolf.
Wow.
There are a lot of, it's a nice connection.
But do you have memories of hearing the BSO when you were in high school?
Well, now, we did not have a lot of money as an Air Force family. I certainly did. And I, by the way, I also played in Symphony Hall. I played the Pines of Rome, speaking of Respighi, and it was telecast. And the principal clarinetist was a student of Buddy Wright as a senior in high school, which was very impressive to us. And David Martin's still plays with us quite often. He's a frequent extra, a very fine musician. So it's also memories of playing in this hall.
Yeah.
And it really deserves its reputation as just about the greatest hall in the world.
And that hall connects, is sort of one of the many connections between the BSO and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. I'm curious about your thoughts about this new partnership that's come up, that you and the Gewandhaus, well, you as an organization and the Gewandhaus, a 5-year partnership centered around Andras as the music director of both organizations. Is the Gewandhaus Orchestra one that you already fairly know well, at least from recordings? And what were your thoughts when the whole thing was announced? I mean, what is it that you're looking forward to as the opportunity from a player perspective?
Well, it's really something. It's very, very nascent. Of course, we've got an exchange going on with chamber music. That's going to be very, very interesting. Of course, we as people that play in Symphony Hall, I guess, was modeled after the Gewandhaus, as was, I believe, the Musikverein. There's a kinship between the three of those halls, I believe.
Yeah.
They're all shoebox.
Yeah.
Although the Musikverein in Vienna is smaller. And, you know, just one of the infinite number of tragedies connected with World War II is what happened to the concert halls. So that...
And the second Gewandhaus being one of those that was destroyed.
The Gewandhaus was one that was totally destroyed.
Henry Lee Higginson had been to and seen and thought, well, that's the kind of thing we should have in Boston.
Right, right. And, of course, they have a modern hall that they're very, very proud of, a big, big facility. Gewandhaus, you know, is a very different situation in a number of ways because it is about 2.5 times the size of ours because they have a full opera season. They have... a Bach, of course, a lot of Bach in Leipzig.
They play every week at the church for
right, and so I can't even begin to understand what kind of what their lives might be like. a wonderful variety, I'm sure, but it must be extremely complex. But it is one of the world's great orchestras, and Leipzig, Dresden, Berlin are all in sort of the pantheon, the Concertgebouw, you know. But I would say, alas, that would be just wonderful to know what it was like to hear that orchestra in our cousin hall.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Another big feature, dominant factor of BSO life right now is Shostakovich. And as players go, every player of a particular instrument sort of looks at composers and thinks of particular, you know, this is the challenge for me or whatever. I come out of playing the trumpet, and so I think of Shostakovich as being pretty challenging from an endurance point of view and volume and blend and all that. I talked to Cindy, the piccolo player, and amazing piccolo parts in Shostakovich. Mm-hmm. What's the oboe angle on Shostakovich? What do you see as the challenge?
His favorite, like many of the Russians, he loved clarinet and bassoon. I think he called the bassoon the soul of the orchestra. And he also wrote many beautiful flute and piccolo parts. He wrote a couple really noticeable, beautiful oboe solos, but considerably less. I'm a little more of a bystander during the Shostakovich project. There are a few famous ones, though, including My favorite symphony of his is number one. I don't know when that's slated to happen.
I just mentioned, yeah,
and,
I was gonna say,
and the slow movement of that is has one of the great oboe solos in it, which I've only done once. And by the way, interestingly, to make connections with Kurt Mazur, whose son Ken assists on the podium, and is a good friend. And that, of course, is the Leipzig connection, because Ken's dad, Kurt, conducted Leipzig, was responsible for building the new Gewandhaus. And he's a fabulous interpreter of Shostakovich, and he is the person, only person that I've done Shostakovich 1 with. Shostakovich 5, by the way, has a very haunting, you know, one of these famous sort of Omo moments when everything is...
Yes,
full and rich and passionate, and then suddenly everything clears out, and there's a very lonely voice. Composers like to do that to oboists, and it's quite high, very challenging. I would say Shostakovich loves pushing registers high and low,
okay,
particularly high on the oboe. He wrote an extraordinary one, very similar to the feeling of that in the 10th. And the one we just recorded... the 7th has this fascinating, rambling, exotic, eerie thing that's all done between pianissimo and pianissimo. So we have challenges and wonderful, wonderful moments. But I would say that my colleagues in flute, piccolo, clarinet, and bassoon are the real stars, particularly bassoon. I mean, some of the bassoon solos go on for, it seems to me, about 4 or 5 minutes, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Symphonic repertoire.
Yeah.
And Richard Svoboda, you know, is incredible with a big canvas. You know, he's just very poised, very has a great sense of the dramatic. So, and by the way, also some terrific English horn, very extended English.
Yes, horn. Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, John Ferrillo, thank you for taking some time to talk with me. It's really
so good
to
be
able
here.
To sit down and
so good to be here.
Talk about all this with you. Thanks.
Wish me luck.
Good luck, John.